The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome, I'm Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about in consultation with your healthcare provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from a variety of sources. Today, these are from around the country, and I'll name those sources as we go along. The first is from the Harvard Health newsletter, and it's a Q&A column. The writer asks the editorial board, "I think I have heartburn, but I hear that what feels like heartburn is sometimes a more serious condition. How do I know if I have heartburn? So what does heartburn feel like?" You've asked an important question, is the answer. Heartburn describes symptoms caused by the reflux of stomach acid up into the esophagus, the tube that carries food from the mouth down to the stomach. It is a burning sensation. You can feel it high in the abdomen, just below the bottom of the breastbone, or underneath the middle of the breastbone in the chest. In other words, despite the word heart in the word heartburn, real heartburn comes not from the heart, but from the stomach and esophagus. Heartburn often starts following a meal, when there's lots of acid in the stomach, or when you're bending over or lying down, allowing gravity to pull acid from the stomach into the esophagus. It can awaken you from sleep. The burning sensation can last minutes or longer, and usually is relieved by swallowing antacids. Heartburn often is accompanied by other symptoms. Acid-tasting stuff, sometimes containing small particles of chewed, partially digested food, can regurgitate up to and irritate your throat, producing a sour or salty taste, or causing you to make so much saliva that it sometimes drips out of your mouth. People who have had heartburn for a long time sometimes have trouble swallowing food because stomach acid has irritated and narrowed the esophagus so that food sticks going down or swallowing becomes painful. Reflux of stomach acid up to the vocal cords in the throat can cause hoarseness, a chronic cough, or wheezing. When you have what seems like just heartburn, what serious conditions should you worry about? If you've had heartburn for a long time, acid can irritate the bottom part of your esophagus and raise the risk of cancer forming there. Heartburn may also be caused by an ulcer in the stomach or small intestine, which can cause serious bleeding or an abdominal infection. If you've had heartburn for many years and done little or nothing about it, your doctor should check it out. Finally, what seems like heartburn can actually be a condition called angina or angina, a symptom caused by the buildup of fatty deposits in the arteries of the heart, which can cause a heart attack and even sudden death. If, along with your heartburn pain, you feel lightheaded or faint, if you break out in a sweat, or if the pain goes into your jaw, your shoulders, your back, or down your arms, contact your doctor. While it still might really be just heartburn, the chance that it's heart trouble is great enough that you need to get it checked out. Moving from Boston to the Mayo Clinic, here's another Q&A from the Mayo Clinic health letter. The question: my colonoscopy is coming up and I'm dreading it. The amount of liquid solution I had to drink the last time was overwhelming and tasted terrible. What are the pluses and minuses of the prep using pills I'm hearing about? According to the American Cancer Society, approximately 38% of eligible Americans, those age 45 and older, that's 45 and older, have never been screened for colorectal cancer or are overdue for their screenings. This means more than one in three adults who need colorectal cancer screening skips the recommended colonoscopy or other colorectal screening. Discomfort or anticipated discomfort with the required bowel preparation often is the main reason that people don't get tested. Many people find that taking pills is easier than drinking large volumes of salty liquid solutions to clear the colon. Sutab, a tablet prep made of sodium sulfate, magnesium sulfate, and potassium chloride, was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2020 and is the main tablet-based colonoscopy prep used today. This prep requires you to take a total of 24 tablets split into two doses. This is paired with drinking at least 6 cups of water with each dose. Studies showed that Sutab was essentially as effective as the standard liquid prep of polyethylene glycol, or PEG, for cleaning the colon. Other pill prep options exist, such as sodium phosphate tablets, but these are used less often because of the risk of kidney damage and electrolyte imbalance. There's a table here that breaks down the advantages and disadvantages of both pill and standard liquid prep operations. So, let's start with pill, the Sutab prep. What are the advantages? It's more convenient, with no large jug of liquid to carry around. There's less nausea reported with this approach. People are more willing to repeat this prep compared with liquid options. And this prep is shown to have fairly equal effectiveness with standard liquid prep. The disadvantages? The number of tablets required can feel overwhelming. You must drink a large volume of water with each dose to prevent dehydration and ensure the prep's effectiveness. This prep can be expensive, and not all insurance plans cover it. It may cause bloating and cramping, and it's not recommended for people with certain gastrointestinal conditions. So, let's look at the standard liquid or PEG prep. The advantages? This prep is well studied and has the longest track record for safety. It can be adjusted for people at higher risk due to conditions such as kidney or heart disease. It provides electrolytes and prevents dehydration for older adults and people who take certain medications. And it's easy to split into two doses, which improves results. The disadvantages? The flavor can be considered unpleasant or cause taste fatigue. The high volume of liquid can cause nausea and vomiting. And it's more common for people to be unable to finish this prep, so the colon isn't fully clean. This means that the healthcare team may not get as clear a view, or the process may need to be repeated. Overall, the most important predictor of a successful prep is not the product itself, but the ability to finish it. Your healthcare team can help you decide what the right method is for you. That may involve using alternative colonoscopy preps, or it could mean opting for different types of colorectal screening that don't require colon preparation. Staying with the Mayo Clinic health letter, this article asks, can aspirin reduce colorectal cancer recurrence risk? A recent study from the New England Journal of Medicine found that a lower daily dose of aspirin might benefit people who've had surgery for colorectal cancer by lowering the odds of the cancer returning. The findings applied specifically to people with changes to the P13KCA gene. These changes cause a crucial signaling pathway in the body to become overactive, thereby promoting the growth of cancer cells. These changes occur in over 1 in 3 people with colorectal cancer. Study participants were assigned to either daily aspirin therapy, 100 milligrams, roughly the equivalent of 2 baby aspirin, or a placebo for 3 years. During this time, the cancer recurred in roughly 14 to 17% of participants who took placebo. It recurred only 7.7% of those who took the aspirin. Overall, those who took aspirin were 55% less likely to have the cancer return. Severe side effects related to aspirin use, such as gastrointestinal bleeding, were rare. According to Mayo Clinic experts, the benefits of using aspirin in situations such as this may outweigh the risks. If you are diagnosed with colorectal cancer and know your genetic status, talk with your healthcare team to see if an option such as an aspirin therapy is worth considering. But it's most important to note that this genetic testing isn't standard, and current guidelines don't support the use of aspirin therapy to prevent colorectal cancer. Staying with the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, this next article is about thumb arthritis, a relatively common condition. While small in scale compared with the rest of the body, the thumb is what sets humans apart from most other species. Its opposable nature allows for a range of precise and crucial movements, such as writing, texting, and picking up objects. But arthritis in the thumb can make these everyday tasks painful. Thumb arthritis, also known as basal joint arthritis, or carpometacarpal CMC joint arthritis, typically develops with age, particularly after 40. Women are most at risk, and there can be a genetic component. Thumb arthritis most often is caused by osteoarthritis, which results from the gradual wear and tear of the cartilage that cushions the joint. Contrary to popular belief, there is no evidence to suggest that cracking your knuckles leads to arthritis. The first sign of thumb arthritis is usually pain at the base of the thumb, especially when gripping or pinching. Other symptoms include stiffness and decreased strength. As the condition progresses, the joint may appear enlarged or develop a bony bump. Diagnosis typically begins with a physical exam, in which a healthcare professional checks for swelling, tenderness, and lessened range of motion. Pressing the base of the thumb against the wrist bone may cause a grinding feeling and pain, indicating cartilage loss. Imaging tests, such as X-rays, can confirm the diagnosis and reveal joint damage. So let's look at the non-surgical treatments first. Non-surgical treatments can offer lasting benefits, including pain relief and improved function. A combination of therapies may be used, including 1. Medications. A topical non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, which is an NSAID, such as diclofenac, known as Voltaren arthritis pain, may provide pain relief without the risks linked with oral NSAIDs. Topical products may be especially effective for finger joints, which are located very close to the skin surface. Short-term use of oral acetaminophen or Tylenol or non-prescription NSAIDs can help with flare-ups. Topical capsaicin, derived from chili peppers, also may help relieve pain without the side effects of oral NSAIDs. 2, there are injections. If pain persists, corticosteroid injections may be an option. The shots sometimes can be repeated if pain returns. Next, there are exercises. Strengthening the muscles that support the thumb joint can improve function and help with pain. A physical or occupational therapist can provide a tailored plan. Next is splinting and bracing. Wearing a supportive splint stabilizes the joint and limits painful movements. You can wear a splint during activities or overnight. They can provide immediate pain relief, but can interfere with some activities. Lastly, there's ice and heat. Applying a cloth-covered ice pack or mild heat for 5 to 10 minutes or more, one or more times a day, can help relieve pain and stiffness. Next, let's look at the surgical options. Surgery is used only when non-surgical treatments no longer provide relief and when pain or loss of function disrupts life. Surgery for thumb arthritis is typically an outpatient procedure, and physical or occupational therapy is recommended after to restore strength and movement. Surgery options include joint fusion, known as arthrodesis. This procedure fuses the bones in the affected joint. It successfully eliminates pain, but reduces mobility. Then there's joint replacement, arthroplasty. This procedure replaces all or part of the damaged thumb joint with an artificial implant. While recovery time is faster than for other surgeries, implants can fail with heavy use. Next is trapeziectomy. This procedure removes the trapezium bone at the base of the thumb, effectively eliminating the arthritis. This is the most common treatment method for thumb arthritis. The space may be filled with a tendon graft to suspend the thumb in its proper position, or suture tape can be used to hold the thumb in position. Last is osteotomy. This procedure involves repositioning the bones in the thumb joint to improve alignment and function, but it can't adequately repair advanced arthritis damage. So, thumbs up. Advances in therapy and surgery continue to improve outcomes and shorten recovery times. Minimally invasive techniques such as denervation are gaining popularity. Denervation is a surgical procedure that selectively cuts the nerves that transmit pain from the arthritic thumb joint while preserving the joint structure and function. Although it does not cure the underlying arthritis, the procedure can provide significant pain relief. While there are no proven ways to prevent thumb arthritis, avoiding repetitive stress and maintaining a healthy body weight can help. If you experience constant pain or difficulty using your thumb, talk with your healthcare team. Next, we turn to an article from Michigan State University Today, and it has a tie to UNC Chapel Hill. It says, "Why chronic pain lasts longer in women. Immune cells offer clues." Chronic pain lasts longer for women than men, and new research suggests differences in hormone-regulated immune cells called monocytes may help explain why. In a new paper in Science Immunology, researchers at Michigan State University reported that a subset of monocytes releases a molecule to switch off pain. These cells are more active in males due to higher levels of sex hormones such as testosterone, the team found. Females, however, experience longer-lasting pain and delayed recovery because their monocytes were less active. Jeffrey Laumet, MSU professor of physiology, and Jaewin Sim, a former graduate student in his lab, discovered the same protein in both mouse models and human patients. These findings, funded by the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Defense, could mean those immune cells can be manipulated into producing more signals to calm pain. While a new treatment is likely decades away, Laumet hopes this research could one day help millions of people experience pain relief with non-opioid treatments and ensure women's pain is taken seriously. The difference in pain between men and women has a biological basis, Laumet said. It's not in your head, and you're not soft. It's in your immune system. Pain results when neurons found throughout your body are activated by stimulation. Most of the time they're silent, but they become activated when you stub your toe or fall on a bike, off a bike. But for those with chronic pain, the sensors may be activated with mild stimulation or even no stimulation at all. Doctors still rely on patients rating their pain on a scale of 1 to 10. The problem is everyone experiences pain differently. So when more women than men complain of long-lasting or chronic pain, the difference is often attributed to perception or reporting. Laumet has devoted his lab to studying pain for 6 years. His team was researching a small pilot project when they noticed higher levels of interleukin-10, or IL-10, in males. When the second test again showed higher levels of the substance that signals to neurons to shut down pain, they realized they were onto something. "That was the turning point for me," Sim said. "I feel extremely fortunate that we trusted those early, uncertain findings and chose to pursue them further. Laumet's lab dove into the research using a sophisticated technique called high-dimensional spectral flow cytometry. They learned that monocytes, long thought to be precursor cells without much of a function, play an essential role and direct role in communicating with pain-sensing neurons by producing IL-10. Laumet's team found that IL-10-producing monocytes were more active in males than in females. When they blocked male sex hormones, they received the opposite result. This study shows that pain resolution is not a passive process, Laumet said. It is an active, immune-driven one. Laumet's team performed at least five types of tests on mouse models to make sure that what they saw wasn't an anomaly. Each time, the results were the same. That's when he reached out to Sarah Lindstedt, a colleague at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who was studying the psychologic outcomes of pain in car accidents. Her research showed a similar pattern. Men had more active IL-10-producing monocytes and resolved pain faster. This new evidence illuminates the immune-neural pain resolution pathway, shifting the thinking from how pain starts to why pain persists. The next step is to investigate how treatments could target this pathway and boost IL-10 production. These treatments could help pain resolve faster instead of just blocking pain signals. Future researchers can build on this work, Laumet said. This opens new avenues for non-opioids therapies aimed at preventing chronic pain before it's established. Now, turning to UCLA Health, this article is entitled, Study Suggests Many Men May Not Need Long-Term Hormone Therapy for Prostate Cancer. Shorter courses of androgen deprivation therapy could reduce risks while still effectively controlling cancer. A study co-led by investigators at the UCLA Health Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center found that most of the benefits of androgen deprivation therapy, or ADT, for prostate cancer occur within the first 9 to 12 months. Extending therapy beyond that provides only small additional protection and increases the risk of other health problems, such as heart or metabolic issues. Results show that the ideal length of ADP depends on cancer risk. Low-risk patients may not need ADT. Intermediate-risk patients benefit from 6 to 12 months. High-risk patients may benefit from up to 12 months, while very high-risk patients may require longer therapy. Here's the background. ADT is a type of hormone therapy that is commonly given alongside radiation to slow the growth of prostate cancer by lowering testosterone. While effective at controlling the disease, long-term ADT can cause side effects, including bone loss, muscle loss, and cardiovascular problems. Current treatment guidelines generally recommend 4 to 6 months of ADT for intermediate-risk patients and 18 to 36 months for high-risk patients. But the optimal duration has been unclear. Researchers conducted a meta-analysis of randomized trials in cancer of the prostate. It's a consortium, using data from 10,266 men across 13 international clinical trials. They assessed outcomes including overall survival, cancer-specific survival, and deaths from other causes, comparing different ADT durations. Impact? The findings highlight the importance of personalized treatment plans for men with prostate cancer. Shorter courses of hormone therapy may be sufficient for many patients, reducing side effects while maintaining effectiveness. Physicians can now use patient-specific factors, including cancer risk, overall health, age, and preference, to make more informed decisions about ADT duration, improving both safety and quality of life. Prostate cancer treatment should not be one size fits all, said Dr. Amar Kishan, professor and executive vice president of radiation oncology, co-director of the Cancer Molecular Imaging Nanotechnology and Theranostics Program at the UCLA Health Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center. That's quite a title. And co-senior author of the study. These findings help doctors personalize therapy, balancing cancer control with patient side effects and other health risks. The study was published in JAMA Oncology. Our last article is from the Oregon Health and Science University News and is entitled Insufficient Sleep Associated with Decreased Life Expectancy. OHSU researchers find catching at least 7 hours of sleep a night will improve how you feel and how long you live. The study, published in the journal Sleep Advances, researchers tapped a vast nationwide database looking for survey trends associated with average life expectancy county by county. They compared county-level data about average life expectancy with comprehensive survey data collected by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention between 2019 and 2025. As a behavioral driver for life expectancy, sleep stood out more than diet, more than exercise, more than loneliness, indeed more than any other factor except smoking. I didn't expect it to be so strongly correlated with life expectancy, said senior author Andrew McKill, associate professor in the OHSU School of Nursing, the OHSU School of Medicine, and the OHSU's Oregon Institute of Occupational Health Sciences. We've always thought sleep is important, but this research really drives that point home. People really should strive to get 7 to 9 hours of sleep, if at all possible. Scientists have broadly understood the importance of sufficient sleep for a variety of positive health outcomes. However, McKill and co-authors said they were surprised by the strength of connection to life expectancy. The effect of insufficient sleep swamped the impact of diet and exercise as a predictor. Although previous research has shown broadly that lack of adequate sleep leads to higher mortality risk, the new research is the first to reveal year-to-year correlation between sleep and life expectancy for every state. Well, that's all we have time for today, for today's issue of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. I'd love to hear from you. As always, we hope you learned something valuable and will continue to tune in to the North Carolina Reading Service.